Good afternoon. I would like to invite you to open up your Bibles again. Turn along with me to the Gospel of Luke in chapter 5. Luke chapter 5. In just a few moments, we're going to pick up reading together in verse 27. Again, it is good to get to see everyone today, our church family. And it's a special treat for me to get to spend time with so many of your families. I feel like I'm living somewhat vicariously through you because my family never comes to see me. And, you know, the fact that I have siblings is really sort of a hypothetical for most of you. And so maybe someday I can offer proof of their existence. But until that time, I'm really excited about the occasions where I get to spend time with all of your families. So we are continuing doing this twice a month in the book of Luke. And we're carrying on the conversation from earlier in the chapter. And in Luke chapter 5, Jesus comes into contact with, let's say, three individuals or groups of people. And each of those occasions provides the opportunity for Jesus to perform some type of miracle. And the thing that all of those have in common is that the reactions communicate something about their willingness to follow the Lord. And so we have the leper who's healed, and he's willing to follow those instructions. But we sort of look at those parallel accounts that talk about what happens after the fact, and we see that he's willing to follow instructions in so much as it makes sense to him. Well, then we have the lame man, and he's healed as well, and he is willing to follow Jesus' instructions exactly to the letter. But then we get to the point of the disciples. And the disciples are not only willing to follow the instructions of the Lord, but they are willing to do so even if it means leaving everything behind. And so as we continue the chapter, we're going to have more occasions for Jesus to call others, more occasions for those interactions, and the themes of willingness to leave everything behind, well, that's going to be continued, but hopefully we'll be expanding on it as well as the reactions that people have just a little bit. So all of this is going to continue as Jesus carries out the call of Levi. I'll apologize in advance. I know the text says Levi, but if I keep stumbling up and saying Matthew, it's okay, because they're the same person. But what we're about to read is within the context of Jesus continuing to call those that we're familiar with. The official call of the 12 out from his group of disciples is not going to happen until the next chapter in Luke chapter 6. That's where Jesus will spend the night in prayer and then separate those 12 individuals from the larger part of the group. But as we're going along, we're seeing Jesus continue to call those who had been associated with him in some degree to come and be a part of following him on a full-time basis, as it were. So let's read in Luke chapter 5, beginning in verse 27. After that, he went out and noticed a tax collector named Levi sitting in the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he left everything behind and got up and began to follow him. And Levi gave a big reception for him in his house, and there was a great crowd of tax collectors and other people who were reclining at the tables with them. The Pharisees and their scribes began grumbling at his disciples, saying, "Why do you eat and drink with the tax collectors and sinners?" And Jesus answered and said to them, "It is not those who are well who need a physician, but those who are sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance." All right, let's look at this section, break it down just a little bit. First thing that we see, already something that Levi has in common with Peter, Andrew, and James. First thing we're introduced to Levi, Levi is a worker. And as we mentioned last time, Jesus calls people to participate in the kingdom who are willing to toil. They're willing to get their hands dirty and busy. That theme of a willingness to work is even present in the Lord's parables. You think about even the parable of those who were called in the 11th hour. Everyone who was called in that parable had a desire to work. There were just those who didn't yet have the opportunity, and yet Jesus was giving it to them. Jesus gives people an opportunity to work. But what's most important is that Jesus gives us the opportunity to take our talents and abilities and channel them into something that has real meaning. There are a lot of people in the world who have all kinds of talent. They can do things that I could never dream of doing. And yet, how do they spend their lives? Pursuing activities and accomplishments that, in light of eternity, and even at the end of the day, are of no importance. Jesus gives us the opportunity for those who are willing to work, those who are willing to do, to put that energy into the greatest work that can be done. But aside from that, the other thing that Levi has in common with those other disciples who have been called is a willingness to leave everything to follow the Lord. It occurs to me, it often does when reading passages like this, that our culture produces all sorts of movements and efforts that are supposedly going to unite us all, and they're going to cause this societal ill or that one to just cease. And if we can all just get behind this movement or this group of people, then we can finally come together and start solving things. Well, our world doesn't produce anything that can really deliver on that promise. What can deliver on that promise is not race or economics or class or privilege, but people who come together with these common traits: a willingness to work for the Lord and a willingness to leave everything behind to do so. And so Jesus gives him a relatively simple command. Just two words: follow me. Yet, those two words have an awful lot of meaning in them. There's so much that goes into the command from the Lord to follow him. As he would say elsewhere in Luke chapter 14 and verse 26, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and his wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. See, follow me means that nothing else can compete. There's no room for competing loyalties or desires. And so when the text says that the reaction of Levi to follow me was to leave it all behind and get up, that's because that's what he understood those words to mean. Leave it behind and come on to something of greater importance. But you know, looking at the Lord's call of Levi, I think there are some things we can bring out that would be a comment on our own efforts to call people for the Lord. If we had to answer honestly, would we have looked at Levi and said, here's someone who's probably going to make an excellent candidate for a worker in the kingdom? You know, we don't even like tax collectors today. And to be honest, some of those guys can be pretty helpful. They can walk you through some tough situations. But they've got a reputation, and so we don't like them. Tax collectors, as we often comment in Jesus' day, were just viewed as the worst of the worst. I mean, we're going to get there in a moment, but the Pharisees are equating them with the same thing as just being an outright sinner. They were traitors, they were cheats, they were dishonest. Why is Jesus calling somebody like this? What could he possibly have to offer as far as the kingdom goes? I think that's an important lesson for me. I have to remind myself that almost on a daily basis, because I'll talk to people and say, now we need to be careful about who we consider to be a good prospect for the gospel. And then I'll go around and someone will come across my path and I'll think, I can't talk to them, they're a crazy person. Or insert excuse here, and I have to back up and remind myself, wait, I don't get to be the judge. I'm not the one who opens the gate. I'm not the gatekeeper. It's just my responsibility to call people and give them the chance to respond. So Jesus looks past those things that are immediately visible, not just with Levi, but with all of the disciples. I mean, these were people who were uneducated, who were uncultured. They were just unqualified in every sense of the word. And yet, Jesus calls them, and what do they end up doing? Well, these are those who have turned the world upside down. And as we think of evangelism, it's hard not to notice what Levi does immediately after he begins to follow Jesus. He throws this feast for his friends. You know, Levi had the attitude, what is good for me is good for others. I've had my life changed by the Lord. I want others to be able to come into contact with the same man and have the same experience that I have. He's like the Cornelius of the apostles, calling his friends and his family together to hear what the Lord has to say. Again, I have to ask myself if I have that same kind of attitude. It reminds me of what Peter describes in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 3, where he says there's a certain way we ought to live if we have tasted of the Lord's kindness. Now, have we all tasted of the Lord's kindness here? Yes. Have we tasted and seen that the Lord is good? Well, absolutely. So why am I not more inclined to share that with others and say, look, you've got to come and see what it is I've got over here. You know, it's embarrassing because here's what will sometimes happen. I'll be driving down the road and I'll see that sign at Culver's. And Culver's will flash up. They've got a special on the flavor of the day. And I'll, special flavor of the day. You know, it's the caramel cashew. I'm going to call someone about this. And I'll call them, and they'll call someone else, and I'll show up, and there might be 15 of us there because we're not going to miss out on this special because it's not every day that they put the caramel cashew on the cheap. You know, we can get excited about so many silly, trivial things, and we got to tell people about it. And yet, when it comes to this, having tasted and seen that the Lord is good, the greatest thing that we can tell, am I following Levi's example in this? What's good for me is good for others. And if I really believe that, if I've tasted and seen, then I'm going to expend more energy and at least trying to get and bring people to come into contact with the Lord. But if we return our focus to the text, we see that in verse 30, not everybody is thrilled with the scene here. Not everyone is happy about what's going on because Jesus is in the company of tax collectors and sinners. And to the Pharisees, those are pretty much a synonymous group. You know, it's one and the same. They are all bad. You know, as a brief aside, was Jesus associating with sinners in our text? It seems like that used to be an open hole that I could put my foot there. I wasn't kicking the podium for emphasis. Although maybe I should try that now again. Was Jesus associating with sinners? Well, the answer is yes. But all complaining is condemned. You know, we think about the Israelites. Was the water bitter when they complained about it? Yeah. Was the road tough when they walked it? Of course it was. Were there giants in the land? Absolutely. Everything they complained about was a legitimate complaint, and yet they are still condemned. You know, the Pharisees, their observation about Jesus was, in a sense, true. Yes, he was associating with sinners, although not in the way that they proposed that he was. When the Pharisees confronted Jesus, they were doing it in a way that they were asking a why question and not really anticipating an answer. They had approached Jesus like a parent who would scold a child and say, "Why would you do this?" Now, the parent doesn't anticipate an answer. And in fact, if one is offered, they're not going to be pleased. But in their minds, there was just no reason or circumstance for Jesus to be associating with people like this. They couldn't imagine the scenario where that would be proper. This is an area, I think, where a lot of people struggle to strike the balance. They don't want to be like the Pharisees, and yet in their efforts to sort of associate with those of the world, they don't exactly wind up producing what Jesus was doing either. We need to understand in this text that Jesus was not camouflaged in the midst of all of the sinners where you couldn't tell that he was there by his actions and deeds. Remember earlier in the chapter when Peter had that realization about who Jesus was and how he felt? Go away. I am an unclean man. Holiness stands out. What this was an opportunity for Jesus to teach. This was an opportunity for Jesus to help others to reform. The sinners that Jesus was in the company of were those who had come to him because they had some measure of a desire to see their lives changed. And so Jesus is not just drifting under the radar in the midst of a bunch of sinners. You know, often people, maybe in an attempt to justify their own practice, will postulate these scenarios where, you know, Jesus would be, if he were here today, he would be going into these bars and he would be trying to reach the people there. Okay, suppose for the sake of argument, Jesus goes into the bar. What do you think happens next? Is it A, barkeep, round for my friends. I want everyone to pay attention to what I have to say here. Or is it perhaps B, someone turn on the lights. You over there, could you turn off the music? Let's quiet down. I have something to say here that's important and that you need to hear. If for the sake of argument Jesus was going to seek sinners out in that context, it would not be in a scenario where you didn't know that Jesus was there. Holiness stands out. Also take special note of what Jesus doesn't say. Again, the Pharisees are making some true observations. These are sinners. How does Jesus react to their assessment? He doesn't say, well, not so fast. These folks aren't all bad. Or, you know, who are you to judge these people? How could you call them sinners? He actually agrees with them. He says, yes, they are sinners. And then he takes it a step further and says, these people are sick. These people are not yet righteous. But they have the opportunity to be. They have the opportunity to obey. Their assessment of the people that he was around was right on. But Jesus wasn't there for the food. Jesus was there because these people needed a doctor. They were sick, they were unwell, and these were not the righteous, but they were those who were in need of repentance. Now, that is not to say, of course, that Jesus didn't desire righteous people to come and respond to his message. But the fundamental portion or call of the gospel is reaching out to those who are in great need of repenting. If the Pharisees could have seen their own need, well, that would have been wonderful. But it's ironic they were unable to see where they stood. Now let's return to our text and continue to read. In verse 33, and they said to him, the disciples of John often fast and offer prayers. The disciples of the Pharisees also do the same, but yours eat and drink. And Jesus said to them, you cannot make the attendants of the bridegroom fast while the bridegroom is with them, can you? But the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them. Then they will fast in those days. He was also telling them a parable. No one tears a piece of cloth from a new garment and puts it on an old garment. Otherwise, he will both tear the new, and the piece from the new will not match the old. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the new wine will burst the skins, and it will be spilled out, and the skins will be ruined. But new wine must be put into fresh wineskins. And no one, after drinking old wine, wishes for new, for he says, the old is good enough. Now, at first reading, this almost seems like a surprise in verse 33, because it looks like the Pharisees and the disciples of John the Baptist are sort of in cahoots here, and that they're opposed to Jesus, especially when you read parallel passages like Matthew 9 and Mark chapter 2. Jesus' first response has to do with explaining the actions of his followers as being appropriate for the situation. Now, fasting is not limited to these occasions, but most of the time fasting is associated with a time of stress, with a time of mourning, or affliction in some way. None of those are appropriate at a wedding feast. A wedding feast is supposed to be a time of rejoicing, of laughter, and if any of those elements are missing, it is a sign that there is tragedy. As in the days of Jeremiah, Jeremiah would speak about the time where there would be wedding feasts that were devoid of laughter, the sounds of rejoicing. Now was not the time. There would be an occasion in Luke chapter 24 and verse 51 when Jesus ascends into heaven. That would be the last time that they would see him, and then they would lose him, and then the time for fasting would be appropriate. But as long as Jesus was in their midst, that was as close to heaven this side of eternity as they were going to experience, and fasting was not appropriate at that time. But Jesus follows up. He's not just explaining the actions of his disciples as being appropriate. This is an opportunity to point out an attitude among the Pharisees that was preventing them from receiving the call of Christ. Starting in verse 36, Jesus is going to deliver three absolute statements. Statements that says, no one does these things. You know, this type of black and white speaking was very common in the prophets, and it was common in the Lord's teaching as well. You know, we don't always like to speak in black and white terms because it makes people uncomfortable. But that's exactly why Jesus taught that way. Speaking in these terms creates tension in the audience. You are either in one camp or you are in the other. You are either for or you are against. And so Jesus delivers absolute statements. No one does these things. The first statement, no one puts new cloth on the old. In the illustration, it doesn't, or it does harm, but then it also does not harmonize. It does not blend together appropriately. But expanding on that, in the second, no one puts new wine into old wineskins. Not only does it do harm, but the end result is that you lost everything that you had to begin with. The skin is ruined and the wine is spilled. But there are perhaps other points that Jesus is making here as well. It's very difficult for people to adapt to the Lord. Whether in Jesus' time or in our time, there is a difficulty of people setting aside their ways and their thoughts so that they can be open enough to accept what Jesus has to offer. You have to put the Lord into a fresh mindset. Putting new wine into old wineskins is not going to work. You can't force Jesus into an old way of thinking. And if you do, it's just going to cause you to lose it all. The message that Jesus was bringing was not just a patch. It wasn't simply something to be put on something else. Jesus came to make all things new, not simply patch up the old. In Jesus, there is a new creature. There's a new creation, a new covenant, a new name, a new song. All things are made new in Christ. He is more than just a patch. I think the third statement is maybe slightly more difficult, at least it is for me, because it does not fit the pattern of these things being appropriate that everyone does. The third statement, I think, speaks more directly to someone who is resistant to change. The third statement describes someone who is satisfied with their way of doing things. They are resistant to what is new, and in this case, what is better. Their insistence on clinging to the old, whether that be, you know, theologically the system of the old covenant, or on a more personal level, just the Pharisees' old and incorrect way of thinking. But their insistence on clinging to what is old did not allow them to be open to what was new. If we're going to follow Jesus, we have to be open and adaptable to the change that He requires, the change that He calls on us to make in His Word. For instance, following Jesus may cost us more than we initially imagined that it would cost us. Following Jesus, if I'm open to everything He asks me to do, may require me to make even more changes than I thought I would ever have to make. And as in the case of some of those He called, following Jesus may call on me to leave more than I ever thought I would leave behind. But as is the case with each of them, and as is the case for all of us, following Jesus is worth more than we can possibly imagine. And so this section of this chapter presents us with, let's say, two groups of people: Levi and his associates and the Pharisees. Their attitudes are presented to us in two very stark contrasts. Those who were open to the Lord and were able to accept His call by putting away their own selves, by putting away their old paths and being open to the new. And those who are resistant to change, who are determined to hold on to what was old and fading, the things that were selfish and they did not want to relinquish. As we draw to a close and we offer an invitation for those gathered, let's give a moment of consideration to those whose lives intersected with the Lord and ask ourselves which of those we want to be like. Which of those we are going to be like. If I want to have the attitude of those who were willing to leave everything behind to follow Jesus, I'm going to excitedly tell others about what I've learned. I'm going to look for ways to share the goodness of the Lord that I have tasted, and I'm going to be willing to make any changes that He asks of me along the way. But if I'm going to be in the other camp, if I want to be like the Pharisees, I'm going to greedily hold on to what I have. I'm going to resist any changes that God might make of me, and I will remain closed to the newness that He has to offer. The choice is ours to make, and we present it to all of those who are gathered this afternoon. You have the opportunity to respond to Jesus now, whether for the first time, by putting Him on in baptism, sharing in His death, and being raised to share in His life, or simply asking for the prayers of the brothers and sisters here. We would be glad to offer them. We'll be glad to help. If we can encourage you in any way, we'd ask that you come while we stand and sing together.